Now, the first couple of Texas Radio. Here's Bill and Allison Mancaro.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. Also, Happy Hanukkah. Hanukkah started this past Thursday at sundown, and it lasts for 8 days.
And last night was the second candle.
Second candle lighting.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't think I was on the air.
You weren't.
No.
Sorry, we should start over. Bill was not on the air. No. Sorry. Bill started using a new microphone recently. So sometimes I forget.
Yeah, I thought
my microphone is always on.
I couldn't hear myself through the headphones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My microphone is always on because I of course, am the most important.
Yeah, there you go. The Allison and Caro show with occasional comment by Bill when he's allowed to when his wife turns on his microphone is the name of the program.
Exactly. Okay, so should we start over?
Go ahead. Well, they heard you. You didn't hear me.
That's true.
Okay. Are you sure you didn't do that on purpose? All right. We begin our program with a verse. This is from the first chapter of Ephesians. And the parenthesis is Christ, because it's talking about Christ. Christ is, parenthesis, far above all principality and power and might and dominion and every name that is named, not only in this world, but also in that which is to come. The Father, again, parenthesis, the Father, has put all things under his feet and gave him to be the head over all things for the glory of the church, the body of Christ. There's a lot packed into that, but it is saying that Christ rules the world, not only this world, but also that which is to come, as it says. And the Father has put, not will put, has already put everything under his feet. He rules everything, and he is the head over all things. Why? For the glory of the church, the body of Christ. That's, if you're a believer, that includes you. All of human history is working toward the glory of the church, the body of Christ. The book of Revelation is a history book. It's the history of the church. And it ends, and it culminates in the Christ coming back and the rule of the world and the new heaven and new earth. Pastor Joe Moorcraft said, history isn't stagnant. It's not going in circles. It's approaching a definite climax, a sudden stop, a glorious consummation. He said, this is no fairy tale. It is a certain fact, for God has declared it. The earth is in the middle of a universal shakedown. Well, we can see that, can't we, in the news? Mm-hmm. Christ is shaking this present age apart, and at the end of history, the only thing left standing will be his kingdom. Pastor Joe Moorcraft. Well, it's a foggy day today, a foggy day.
And very strange fog in Kerrville.
Hill country town. Yeah. The Old Farmer's Almanac says that wetter than usual weather is coming to Texas this winter with potentially drought-quenching rain. That's good news. Last time I looked, we were about half of the normal rainfall we should have had for the year. We're looking for a mild winter, they say, but a wet, mild and to cool winter with a lot of rain. That's what the Old Farmer's Almanac predicts, and they've been predicting since, I don't know, they first published in 1794. Don't think they had weather forecast back then, but they have for decades, and their track record is 80% correct, even predicting a year or more in advance.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Did you know, Bill, that Fredericksburg has the highest per capita number of millionaires in the state of Texas?
How about that?
And Kerrville has the second highest.
Per capita.
Per capita.
So that means if you just took 1,000 people at random in Fredericksburg, you would and you put 1,000 people at random in, say, Dallas, and you got their net worth, you would find more people who have a net worth of $1 million or over in Fredericksburg than you would in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Or Kerrville, for that matter.
Exactly.
How about that?
Yeah. I don't know how the other cities rate.
I don't either. Well, in 1838, on this date, Mirabeau Bonaparte Lamar was inaugurated as the second president of the Republic of Texas. Now, his predecessor, oh, I ruined my what? I have a trivia question for you, but I've already ruined it, but I might as well tell you. Who is the only person ever to have been a governor, a United States senator, and president?
Sam Houston.
You've heard that before.
I knew that.
But that's a trivia question you can use on your friends. Who is the mm-hmm. only person ever to be a governor, a U.S. senator, and president? And they will scratch their heads and wonder. but it's Sam Houston, president of the Republic of Texas, of mm-hmm. course. Well, at Lamar's inauguration as the second president of the Republic of Texas, Sam Houston, who preceded him, dressed up in colonial costume, including a powdered wig, and gave a farewell address that lasted 3 hours.
Oh, gee.
let's see. Also, this week in 1928, Dan Blocker was born in DeKalb, Texas. Hmm. Dan Blocker was, of course, on Bonanza. You can still see him on Bonanza. He taught school in Sonora. Then he moved to California, and he played Hoss Cartwright on Bonanza for 13 seasons. And Bonanza was one of the longest-running and most popular TV series in history.
Hmm.
Bonanza.
How about that?
Yeah.
And we, several years ago, were out in Bonanza Country. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Is that Reno, that area?
I don't remember.
I think it's around Reno. Okay. Well, they show the map at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's Reno.
Exactly.
Of course, that's all fake.
Did you know that this past week, on Thursday, December 7th, marked the 82nd anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor that drew the U.S. into World War II?
A day that will live in infamy, according to President Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're listening. A guest on our show today will be the director of the Museum of Western Art in Kerrville, a real hill country gem.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're going to be talking about Daryl later, but he made the point that, he makes the point that Hollywood movies do not show the real West, particularly the real Texas. Like, for example, the John Wayne movies were made in Monument Valley, Utah, or Arizona, I guess it is.
Well, maybe some of them, but there is a town not too far outside San Antonio, and I think we've driven by
where the Alamo was made.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay,
the Alamo was made outside of San Antonio.
Okay, but
the movie,
but I think there were several several Texas movies that were made there.
A lot of them just don't, you know, they were made in places that people don't live, you know,
right.
Like Monument Valley. But, well, Billy Strayhorn was born this week in 1915. Now you say, who is Billy Strayhorn? Well, he's not as well known as the man whose orchestra he played. Billy Strayhorn was a pianist, arranger, and composer, and he in the Duke Ellington Orchestra. And by the way, Allison, he was born in Dayton, Ohio.
Hmm. Okay. And,
yeah. Passed away in 1967. But one of his most famous songs is this. And it's called Take the A Train, and we're going to play just a little bit of it so it reminds you of the great Billy Strayhorn. Well, that's Take the A Train, and written by Billy Strayhorn, who was born. That's our little tribute to Billy Strayhorn. Yeah, Take the A Train, one of my favorites. We were in, where were we? I don't know, walking down the street in Memphis or someplace, and in an area where they had a lot of music venues, and about half a block away, we heard Take the A Train, and so we went to that little club, and it was really very cool. Very cool. I used to style myself as a musician, and that's kind of some of the kind of music I love. I like most kind of musics. I like most kind of musics, yes.
Well, I think I announced the news to you. I don't think you knew this, but...
I don't know much.
Taylor Swift, Time Magazine picked Taylor Swift as their 2023 Person of the Year. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Her contributions.
She contributed more to society and the world than any other person.
Well, more than you.
More than me?
The Fed gave her a shout-out for boosting the U.S. economy this summer through massive spikes in hotel bookings surrounding her concert dates. Mm-hmm. When she showed up at a game where her new boyfriend is a team member, the ticket sales were up 8%.
Well, didn't you tell me that people stayed someplace in South America or something?
I think it's Argentina. She has an upcoming concert. And people, last I heard, people had been camping out for 5 months because they want first row seats.
Don't they work for a living?
Yeah, apparently not. Apparently not. And her upcoming concert is the very first concert to pass gross revenue of $1 billion.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Hmm. Well, and she herself became a billionaire this year.
Wow. Wow. Well, I hope she uses her money wisely. Well, thanks to the efforts of the Texas Nationalist Movement, which frankly I'd never heard of before until this story came out, looks like there's going to be on the Republican primary ballot this year, because they've collected enough signatures. The question: should the state of Texas reassert its status as an independent nation? And that, if their signatures are verified, because they gathered 102,000 or more signatures, which is more than the 97,709 signatures required by the law to obtain a ballot spot, and the signatures are being checked now, but that's what they think is going to happen. The petition is only going to appear. Well, that question, rather, is only going to appear on the Republican ballot. It's non-binding in nature. It basically gauges voter sentiment on Texas independent. There's been a lot of pro-secession sentiment among Republican voters in Texas. A couple years ago, there was a poll, and it showed over half of Texas Republican voters are in favor of seceding from the United States. How about that?
Wow.
Well, there are several practical questions about that. Because if Texas secedes, what happens to your Social Security and Medicare?
Exactly.
Medicaid?
Exactly.
Well, Medicaid is a state thing, so that would stay there. But what happens to all that stuff?
Right. Right. Those are issues.
Thorny issues to face if Texas ever decides to secede.
Mm-hmm.
Just like we read about President Lamar and Sam Houston.
Mm-hmm. So
Texas was once a republic, and talking to our friend Judge Doug Ginsburg last night, he had a trivia question, and I admit I did not know the answer. What, other than Texas, what state was an independent country at one time?
I remember I was there when he said it.
You were there. Now, my guess, the previous couple of days when I was with him, he asked me that question. I didn't know the answer. I guessed California. You know, you think of California because they say they were a republic, but I don't think that, I don't know. I'd have to look at the history. I don't think they ever were actually a republic.
Mm-hmm.
But do you know the answer?
Vermont.
Vermont is the answer. Very good, Allison. You win the $1 million.
Doug told me last night.
Yeah, well, you win the $1 million. Vermont was not part of the 13 colonies, and it's an independent country.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that. Thank you, Doug Ginsburg, Judge Ginsburg. Well, it's been in the news a lot. I think it was leading the news. Was it? I don't think. It was leading the news in our newscast just before we went on the air this morning. These university presidents testified in Congress this week. And if you hadn't heard the story,
you'll hear it now.
You'll hear it now. The presidents of Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, and MIT, with Massachusetts Technology, refused in a hearing before Congress. Congresswoman Elise Stefanik from New York said, ask them a very straightforward question. No decent person would have a moment's trouble answering. And the question was, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate your school's code of conduct All three refused to answer that question. They refused to answer that question. See, because among Democrats, calling for the genocide of Jews is not bullying, harassment, or hate speech. Frankly, if you're shocked by that fact, you haven't been paying attention. So here it is in their own words, or their refusal to use the words of condemning Jewish genocide. This is the Congresswoman Elise Stefanik asking the presidents of Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, and MIT.
Mm-hmm.
University of Penn and the Penn. MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the question, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate your school's code of conduct?
Calling for the genocide of Jews does not constitute bullying and harassment?
I have not heard calling for the genocide for Jews on our campus.
But you've heard chants for Intifada.
I've heard chants, which can be anti-Semitic depending on the context, when calling for the elimination of the Jewish people.
So those would not be according to the MIT's code of conduct or rules?
That would be investigated as harassment, if pervasive and severe.
Ms. McGill, at Penn, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Penn's rules or code of conduct? Yes or no?
If the speech turns into conduct, it can be harassment, yes.
I am asking, specifically calling for the genocide of Jews, does that constitute bullying or harassment?
If it is directed and severe or pervasive, it is harassment.
So the answer is yes.
It is a context-dependent decision, Congresswoman.
It's a context-dependent decision. That's your testimony today. Calling for the genocide of Jews is depending upon the context. That is not bullying or harassment. This is the easiest question to answer yes, Ms. McGill. So is your testimony that you will not answer yes?
If it is, if the
yes
speech
or
becomes,
no.
If the speech becomes conduct, it can be harassment, yes.
Conduct meaning committing the act of genocide? The speech is not harassment? This is unacceptable, Ms. McGill. I'm going to give you one more opportunity for the world to see your answer. Does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Penn's code of conduct when it comes to bullying and harassment? Yes or no?
It can be harassment.
The answer is yes. And Dr. Gay, at Harvard, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Harvard's rules of bullying and harassment? Yes or no?
It can be, depending on the context.
What's the context?
Targeted as an individual. Targeted as at an individual.
It's targeted at Jewish students, Jewish individuals. Do you understand your testimony is dehumanizing them? Do you understand that dehumanization is part of antisemitism? I will ask you one more time. Does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Harvard's rules of bullying and harassment? Yes or no?
Anti-Semitic rhetoric. When it
and is it anti-Semitic rhetoric?
Anti-Semitic rhetoric when it crosses into conduct that amounts to bullying, harassment, intimidation, that is actionable conduct, and we do take action.
So the answer is yes, that calling for the genocide of Jews violates Harvard code of conduct, correct?
Again, it depends on the context.
It does not depend on the context. The answer is yes, and this is why you should resign. These are unacceptable answers across the board.
Well, billionaire investor Bill Ackman said all three presidents should resign in disgrace, and Pfizer CEO called it one of the most despicable moments in the history of U.S. academia.
Yeah.
Now, I must say that the Harvard president is now backtracking.
Of course, they're backtracking. She wants to keep her job.
Yeah, well, I think she's the only one of the three. But really, I mean, really, it takes her what, 4 days to, or whatever to to backtrack.
But she doesn't. She still believes what she believes.
Yeah,
she
exactly.
just wants to keep hang on to her job.
Exactly.
Now, these people.
Exactly.
These people are evil. Mm-hmm. You can't change evil. No amount of shaming them is going to change evil. This is how they operate. This is how the left operates. Sexualize, mutilate children, let rapists out of prison, refuse to discipline your own students, calling for the murder of Jews? What if they called for the murder of Muslims?
Yeah, exactly.
What would happen then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, disgusting. Disgusting. I hope they're all fired, but they won't be. They won't be. Or if they're fired, they'll be replaced by somebody equally evil.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just absolutely amazing that's going on in this day and age.
Yeah, it sure is. It sure is.
Okay. Coming up after this quick break, we're going to have a woke alert.
We find the worst examples of wokeness and let you know about them. So that's coming up right after the break. And
right after Mariah sings to you.
Mariah, Allison's favorite Christmas song.
I don't care.
Mine too,
about
I think.
Santana, welcome back. We're Bill and Allison, Hill Country Patriot, your information station.
Yes, we are. Oh, there you go.
Well, that's our woke alert.
It's not a fire. It's not an air raid.
The most outrageous story of the week. U.S. border agents are told to use woke language. An internal memo instructs CBP agents not to assume an illegal immigrant's gender identity. The Biden administration has instructed...
Instead of enforcing the border, Biden is more concerned with closing off the Ukrainian border than he is the American border.
Yeah. Yeah. The Biden administration has instructed U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, agents not to use he, him, she, her pronouns when dealing with the public, the public, parentheses, illegal aliens. Personnel are told to only use woke language when encountering individuals invading the United States. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, tells CBP staff to use gender-neutral language and the self-identified pronouns and name of any members of the public they interact with. Again, illegal aliens, illegal immigrants. Do not use he, him, she, her pronouns until you have more information about or provided by the individual. The memo states, it also cautions against using salutations such as Mr., Mrs., Ms., Sir, or Ma'am. How about that? That is your tax dollars at work. Your tax dollars.
And what is so monumentally stupid about that? Well, let me count the ways. A lot of the people crossing over are from Mexico and countries in Central and South America where they speak Spanish. Hello, do you know how masculine oriented Spanish is? You can have a stadium of 100,000 women in a stadium, in a football stadium, let's say, and only one man. And in Spanish, that crowd is referred to in the masculine because there's a man there. That's what, but, oh, no, we can't call Miss and Mrs. and Senora and Senorita. No, we can't do that. And look, and a lot of them are coming over a Muslim. And in some countries, women are not permitted, like Saudi Arabia, women are not permitted to drive. They're not permitted to be in public without their husband. There's genital mutilation of women, ritual genital mutilation of women. Yet we're so woke that we can't assume that they're women. My Lord. Well, you know, we were talking before the break about these woke university presidents and how they could not answer the question of calling for the murder of Jews as being wrong. Did a little research. Not very long ago, the supreme leader, the Grand Ayatollah of Iran, was urging the Muslim world, he still is, to boycott anything and everything that originates with the Jewish people. Okay. Well, let's look at that. Any Muslim who has syphilis must not be cured by the drug Salvarsan because it was discovered by a Jew. He shouldn't even try to find out whether he has syphilis because the Wasserman test was also discovered by a Jew. Same with gonorrhea. He'll be using the method of a Jew named Dr. Nessner. Muslim who has heart disease must not use digitalis, who was discovered by Dr. Traub, a Jew. If he has a toothache, he can't use Novocaine because Drs. Waddell and Weil discovered those. They're both Jewish. A Muslim has diabetes, he can't use insulin. Dr. Minkowski, a Jew, discovered that. A headache, a couple of drugs he can't take due to the Jews. Muslims with convulsions must put up with them because it was a Jew who proposed the use of chloral hydrate. And should a Muslim child get diphtheria, he can't go to use the Schick reaction invented by a Jew. Muslims should be ready to die in great numbers and not permit treatment of ear and brain damage because Dr. Robert Barham, a Jew, that was his work and won the Nobel Prize for it. What about infantile paralysis? Well, the discoverer of the anti-polio vaccine is a Jew, Jonas Salk. Muslims must refuse to use streptomycin. Die of tuberculosis because a Jew, Dr. Waxman, invented streptomycin against tuberculosis. And Muslim doctors have to throw out all discoveries and improvements by Dr. Judas Benedict, a dermatologist, or the lung specialist, Dr. Frankel, and many other world-renowned Jewish scientists and medical experts. So they're going to have to, Muslims, if they follow what the Ayatollah says in Iran, boycott everything that originates with Jews, they're going to suffer with syphilis, gonorrhea, heart disease, headaches, typhus, diabetes, mental disorders, polio, convulsions, tuberculosis because of this. Oh, and don't call for a doctor on your cell phone because the cell phone was invented in Israel by a Jewish engineer and also by...
I always forget her name.
Oh, famous actress.
Okay. Shoot, and we were at her home. Mm-hmm. Hedy Lamarr.
Hedy Lamarr.
Was she Jewish?
Yes. So she invented actually the technology that mm-hmm. now
cell
is
phones.
Cell phones,
mm-hmm.
radar, a lot of radar things and all mm-hmm. that.
And that was during World War II.
Yeah. So, by the way, what medical contributions to the world have the Muslims made? Okay. Well, look, the global Islamic population is approximately 1,200,000,000, about 20% of the world's population. Now, they've received 7 Nobel Prizes. The global Jewish population is approximately 14 million. That is about 0.02% of the world's population. Jews have received 129 Nobel Prizes. And the Jews aren't promoting brainwashing children in military training camps or teaching them how to blow themselves up to cause maximum death of Jews and other non-Muslims. They don't hijack planes. They don't kill athletes at the Olympics. They don't blow themselves up in restaurants. There's not one single Jew who has destroyed a church or protesting by killing people. They don't traffic slaves. They don't have leaders calling for jihad and death to the infidels and Antifa, Antifada. Maybe the world's Muslims, the radical ones, we're not talking about all of them, we have Muslim friends and they don't believe all this stuff, but maybe the radicals, should consider investing more in standard education and less in blaming the Jews for all their problems. So no matter how you feel about what's going on in Israel and the Gaza and all that, if the Arabs put down their weapons today, there would be no more violence. But if the Jews put down their weapons today, there'd be no more Israel. Yeah.
Very good point.
Yeah. That's some interesting statistics, I thought, to keep things in perspective. Mm-hmm. Keep things in perspective.
Well, I don't know if we have CVS anyplace here in Hill Country. Do you know, Bill?
CVS Pharmacy?
Mm-hmm.
Kerrville.
Oh, you're right. You're right. I've totally forgot. But they are overhauling how it prices prescription drugs. They've announced that they're promising that their new model will be more transparent than the current setup, which prices drugs based on complex reimbursement formulas, reimbursement to insurance companies, that can make the costs of prescriptions confusing for consumers. The new model, called CVS Cost Vantage, is based on a simple equation. Drugs will cost what CVS paid for them, plus a limited markup and a flat fee to cover the services of fulfilling the prescriptions. And that's similar to a plan proposed by Mark Cuban, who's the founder of Cost Plus Drugs. And they're both trying to bring accountability to drug pricing in the U.S. And if anybody's ever been outside the United States and bought prescription drugs, the difference is just incredible. A drug that I buy, for example, you have to have a prescription in the United States, and it costs about $125. But in Mexico, for example, you can buy it across the counter for about $30.
Hmm.
And it just goes on and on like that.
Hmm.
Well, and they're the same drugs.
Good for CVS.
Yeah, they're the same drugs. In Mexico, for example, and Canada.
Mm-hmm. Well, the diplomats and heads of state of nearly 200 countries are dining on gourmet Wagyu steaks in Dubai this week, where they're attending the 28th United Nations Conference of the Parties on Climate Change. And one of the main goals of the conference is to make sure you eat less meat. Seriously. They're dining on Wagyu steak, but you got to eat less meat. They ain't serving any bugs at the UN climate change deal. There's a new study that came out, where did it come out? Just a month or so ago, a couple of months ago, that says lab-grown meat could actually be, is far worse for the environment than livestock.
Hmm.
The study said if current techniques being used to produce fake meat, like impossible, whatever they call it, and all, I don't buy it, obviously, and I see it sitting on the shelf.
I was going to say, is it available at HEB?
Yeah, I think they have a little section there, and but Walmart has a little section.
Bill does the grocery shopping in our family.
And there's, I even know where CVS is. But no, it, if, you know, I look at these little sections of the fake meats and all that, and that nobody seems to be buying them. There's no, like, empty spaces. It's just always full. But anyway, according to this study, if the current techniques of putting these lab-grown cultured meats were scaled up to supply the market, they would produce up to 25 times more CO2 than traditional methods of livestock.
Wow.
25%. The hype around cultured meat, researchers have found, is based on flawed analyses of carbon emissions. The increased levels of CO2 are associated with the fossil fuels needed during purification process that supply these cultured cells with nutrients. They're basically, the fake meat is a pharmaceutical product. And I haven't done the research, but I'd bet you $1,000 that Pfizer and Moderna and the rest of these companies, Bayer, is heavily invested in these lab-grown meats because they're pharmaceutical products.
Yeah.
They're not made by chefs. They're made by factory workers and engineers.
Right. In a factory.
In a factory.
Not in a kitchen. Not in a kitchen.
Factory. And this is supposed to be healthy for you.
Yeah.
No, it's more death and destruction. Yeah. We got a quick break coming up. And when we come back, got some news about Nikki Haley that you probably haven't heard. That's because at the Hill Country Patriot, it's our business to tell you what others don't. So come back, you'll be shocked to hear what Nikki Haley believes.
Welcome back. We're Bill and Allison.
We are indeed back with you on the Hill Country Patriot, your information station. Allison's pointing at her lips. Do I have a cold sore or something?
No. Now I was wondering what you're going to say.
Oh, I always wonder what I'm going to say. Is that Santa? Santa's at the door?
It's getting close.
Yeah, he is. He is. These headphones need to be turned on.
Okay.
So a little behind-the-scenes radio talk there. Okay. Well, before the break, we promised to tell you about what Nikki Haley believes about a certain subject. We're going to play a real, I think it's 15-second mm-hmm. clip of she was asked on CNN, and you'll hear what she had to say.
What care should be on the table when a 12-year-old child in this country assigned female at birth says, actually, I feel more comfortable living as a boy? What should the law allow the response to be?
Well, I think the law should stay out of it, and I think parents should handle it.
Okay, well, that was Nikki Haley, presidential candidate Nikki Haley.
Exactly.
Yeah, she thinks children should be allowed to be mutilated if they feel like it.
Yeah, the government should not intervene if parents decide to permanently mutilate their children. I thought child abuse was a problem. You know, should be prosecuted. But she said, so somebody responded that chopping off body parts of children, putting them on cancer-causing hormone drugs is a line I'm not willing to cross. Somebody else says she's probably getting paid by Big Pharma. Somebody said you have to be 18 to get a tattoo and 21 to buy alcohol, but a sex change for a 12-year-old is perfectly fine. And somebody else commented, kids will follow all sorts of trends based on peer pressure, and it's fine if it means having a weird haircut or clothing, but being sterilized for life is an entirely different thing. So that's mm-hmm. what Nikki Haley thinks, that the government shouldn't be involved. There shouldn't be laws against, you know, your 12-year-old or 10-year-old wanting to permanently mutilate their bodies. And she just, yeah, that's fine. We'll go ahead with that.
What you got,
Allison?
Well, okay. J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon and Senator Elizabeth Warren don't see eye to eye on much. So it was a surprise that they found something to agree on when bank CEOs came to Congress for a hearing on the industry this past week, hating on crypto. Dimon, who expressed his skepticism toward crypto in the past, said the only true use case for the digital currency is for criminals, and the government should get rid of it. Warren noted, when it comes to banking policy, I'm not usually holding hands with the CEOs of multi-billion dollar banks, but this is a matter of national security. And Elon Musk has said, crypto scares the hell out of me.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. No kidding. Well, you know, crypto is... the Fed hates crypto because they want their own crypto called central bank digital currency. And Biden has already authorized a, quote, study, and all his studies, of course, become reality, where there'll be no more banks. All of your accounts will be with the federal government. And it'll be like the Chinese system. They're copying the Chinese system, what's called a social credit system, which means that the government has control of your money. And if you express opinions in China, for example, if you express opinions the government doesn't like, you get punished for that. But you maybe you can't get a loan, can't get a mortgage, you can't travel. You're limited on what you can buy in the grocery store, all this kind of stuff. And it's central bank digital currency would be total control of everyone, which is their goal. That's what they want. That's what they want.
Did you know that Russia's Supreme Court has banned LGBTQ plus activism?
No kidding.
Russia's highest court ruled that the International Gay Rights Movement is an extremist organization. And experts say the ruling could put gay people and their allies at risk of prosecution and jail time for merely displaying a rainbow pride flag.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
No kidding.
And since, I'm not sure how this is related, but since invading Ukraine last year, Russia has increased its efforts to curtail LGBTQ plus rights in order to maintain what Vladimir Putin calls Russian traditional values and position itself against the degrading influence of the West.
Wow.
Yeah, about
that's
that.
Putin?
That's Putin, yeah.
Well, no wonder Biden hates him. Hmm? Well, I'll tell you what, on the opposite side of that, okay, Russia's doing that, but in Reading, Pennsylvania, quoting the Bible and yelling derogatory things at a gay pride event doesn't go over in Reading, Pennsylvania. A man was arrested in less than 60 seconds, placed in handcuffs, and charged all while he was attempting to quote the Bible at a gay pride event in Reading, Pennsylvania. He was not arrested for quoting the Bible. He was arrested while quoting the Bible. There's a difference. Nam's main is Damon Atkins. He was standing at this pride. By the way, I thought pride was a sin. What happened to that? Okay. And here's what happened. This is from the Lancaster Patriot newspaper. Quote, the video, there's a video of this, caught on video by one of the bystanders. The video begins with the person making the video narrating and explained that he preached until, quote, he preached, the guy making the video, until, quote, a cop got in my face, laid hands on me, and threatened to arrest me if I didn't stop. And he says they've got drag queens and sexually performing in front of children. The cops didn't stop that. He says it's a satanic cesspit. Looks like some more men just showed up to support us. This cop is going to give him a hard time. The video shows Police Sergeant Bradley McClure approaching Damon Atkins, and the two interact for about 25 seconds. Atkins said it was public property, but the officer told him to let the gay pride people have their event and to respect them. Although it's unclear what exact crime Atkins would be committing by simply being there and quoting the Bible. And Atkins told the Lancaster Patriot newspaper he was going to quote a portion of 1 Corinthians 14:33, God is not the author of confusion, but did not finish the quote because he was stopped by being handcuffed by the police officer. And according to an affidavit, the police officer McClure says that Atkins was carrying a sign with a slogan written on it that showed his opposition to the event. Apparently, that's illegal in Reading, Pennsylvania. Free speech is apparently illegal.
You can't be opposed to an event like that?
No. The video shows Atkins holding a sign that read, Jesus said, go and sin no more. And apparently, the police officer took that as being opposed to the gay pride event.
Wow.
So it's a sin in Reading, Pennsylvania it's illegal to call that a sin. In the affidavit, the officer also claimed that Atkins, quote, began to yell to the people that are attending the pride event. So you can't yell in Reading, Pennsylvania. The cop said, quote, I immediately approached him and told him that while he was free to stand on the side of the street and hold his sign, he could not cross the street nor yell comments.
Wow.
Yeah. Atkins was arrested and charged with disorderly conduct.
Wow.
So we ain't going to Reading, Pennsylvania anytime soon.
No. That's the evil state.
The evil state.
We have a friend from Pennsylvania who calls it the evil state.
I know. We didn't make that up. We did not make that up, no. But it's actually, Pennsylvania's got some very nice air. It's a beautiful state.
Mm-hmm.
Poconos and all that. We used to live in Northern Virginia, and we went to the Poconos. And
all that. I didn't think I'd ever been to the Poconos.
Never mind.
Oh. You went to the Poconos with somebody else, didn't you?
Just on a fact-finding.
See, the Poconos are known for romance.
I went on a fact-finding mission. I went on a fact-finding
mission. I've never been there. But Bill has.
Well, that wasn't like yesterday or last week. We lived married long enough. You would know if I went to the Poconos by myself.
That's true.
Well, we're coming up on a hard break, our news feature, and when we come back, we're going to tell you all about the events going on in Hill Country this weekend, so you'll be able to go with yourself. You can go with yourself if you want, or with your family, but all these events going on in the Hill Country, we did a lot of research and tell you what's going on and where and when. And also, we have an exclusive interview in the studio. We're very pleased Dr. Daryl Beecham, who is the executive director of the Museum of Western Art in Kerrville, will be with us right after this important news break. So stay with the Bill and Allison Mancaro Show on the Hill Country Patriot, your information station. We'll be right back after the news.
Now, the first couple of Texas Radio.
Well, in the studio, we are very privileged to have Dr. Daryl Beecham. Dr. Beecham is the executive director of the Museum of Western Art, which is certainly a treasure of the Texas Hill Country. We're very, very honored to have it in Texas Hill Country. Dr. Beecham.
Hey, good morning.
Dr. Daryl.
Yeah.
How are you?
Good to see you on an early Saturday morning for me.
Yeah. Well, last night we had the privilege to see Dr. Beecham. He spoke to the very prestigious Law and Economics Center of the George Mason University Antonin Scalia Law School, and we saw him last night in San Antonio.
Yeah, that was interesting. It was terrifying.
Yeah.
Why, and just because there are a whole bunch of federal judges?
Yeah, just a bunch of federal judges, you know? And, you know, you got guys like, you know, Douglas Ginsburg and, you know, some of these people like Larry Benitez, who, you know, he's a Second Amendment advocate, you know, judge. He's an originalist. And, man, I mean, it was just frightening because some of these guys, I wasn't really worried about it until I looked them up. You know, I did my research. I thought, you know, I'm going to speak to a bunch of guys who, you know, no big deal. But then you start looking and, oh, my gosh. I mean, there's a guy appointed to the Supreme, you know, nominated to the Supreme Court. There's a guy who's, an originalist on the Second Amendment. And he's got T-shirts made about him, you know, among the gun rights groups. And so, yeah, I mean, once I got, but they turned out fine.
Yeah,
good group. Yeah, they were really excited.
You had a great story about Doug Ginsburg that you told Bill. When you told your son,
well, yeah,
that you were working
this,
with Judge Ginsburg,
this kind of blind, and I started talking to my son because, you know, my son is an attorney and a municipal judge in Corsicana, Texas, and I said, I'm gonna be speaking to this group of, you know, at the George Mason down, and I told him all about it. He said, that's cool, that's a big conference, big thing. He said, a bunch of high end people go to that, you know. I said, well, yeah. I said, my host is a guy named Doug Ginsburg, and there was silence on the other end of the line. He said, Dad, he's a rock star.
A legal rock star.
He's a legal rock star. I told Judge Ginsburg that, you know. I mean, this is a guy who was nominated by Reagan for the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. you know, to be an associate justice. And he's been dean of this and dean of that, you know. And he said, yeah, these guys are the people we read about in law school. You know, and we study their opinions on things. And
wow.
He said, yeah, so that's a big deal. And I said, well, okay. I hang pretty pictures on the wall. You know?
Well, you did a great, great job. We were so pleased that we wanted to have Dr. Beecham, Dr. Daryl on the program today. And we wanted to talk a little bit about the Museum of Western Art.
Yeah, what a great place. I mean, in Kerrville, Texas, the number 3 ranked museum in the nation according to True West magazine.
No kidding.
Yeah, you know. Wow. And, you know, I've got buddies in the business who weren't ranked this year, so it's not an important thing.
that's what you say when you're ranked number 23.
When you're like 23, yeah, something. You know.
That's all politics.
But it's all politics. It's all, you know, you get the publicity out there at the right time, you know. And we were having a good day when the secret shopper came by, you know, from True West magazine to visit with us. Huh. But, yeah, they ranked us number 3. It's the third year in a row for 2024. It's the third year in a row that we've been ranked in the top 10.
Hmm.
We were number 5 last year, number 3.
What's their criteria?
You know, it's a lot of different things. And again, it is one of those kind of beauty contests, how few people feel. They look at your collection. They look at your, you know, your museum, your facility. They send secret shoppers around, you know, people who do an evaluation, come in, see how they're treated, you know, what's up on the walls, those kinds of things. It's an overall kind of experience. And it is at some level a beauty contest, you know, how you were caught on a certain day, right? I mean, any museum in the country worth its salt could be in that list at any given time. But, you know, when we drop out of the top 20, it'll be just be another beauty contest. It doesn't matter. For us, it's a pretty important deal. But, you know, it's exciting. And then we've got it right here in Kerrville, Texas. You know, Allison, I was listening to, you know, Bill talk about the various events, and you said, well, there's just nothing to do in Kerrville, Texas. And we tell people all the time, if you're bored in Kerrville, Cook County, in the Hill Country, you're just out of your mind.
Because, oh, exactly.
My gosh, there's so much to do, and we're one of those things, right? Yeah, I mean, exactly. We're open 10 to 4 Saturday, you know, Tuesday through Saturday. And I'm kind of like that car dealer in Carthage, Texas. I'll meet you at 2 in the morning if I know you're coming, right? I mean, by appointment, we can make it happen for you. Well, we're a little museum with a big attitude, with a big, you know, with big ideas, and taking care of the American West.
Don't you sometimes host the First Friday Wine Share?
No, well, we have hosted First Friday, but we do our own Wild West Wine Wednesday, the first Wednesday of every month, in February through December. We don't do January because it usually falls on the first or the second, which is, you know, the way it's been the last couple of. But we bring in wineries. You know, you were talking about that wine tour thing. Yeah. People can buy the tickets and go to 40 wineries. There's 60-something wineries in this part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so we host a winery every month. We bring in a new winery. Last month was Lost Draw Cellars,
mm-hmm.
a great little winery. And Monique talked about her winery and talked about the products they have available, their memberships, their clubs, if you will. It gives our guests a chance to, you know, hear about the wineries in person and go visit them. They feel like they've been welcomed. We talk about art. We had Ron Riddick, a famous Western artist, talking about his art this past Wednesday. So every month is wine and art.
Now,
and we get together and the winery serves samples of their works. And we talk about art and give people a chance to tour the museum for free. So
very cool.
Yeah, member advantage kind of thing. So
how would people get more information on that?
All they got to do is go out to the Museum of Western Art's website at museumofwesternart.com.
Okay.
Museumofwesternart.com or call the museum. It's really very simple.
Is it open to the public?
It is, yeah. Okay. It's billed as a membership event, but, you know, everybody who comes through the door is a potential member.
There you go.
So we're gonna treat them like a member, and we get a lot of people who join for that reason. They come and they try it out. They want to kind of see, you know, mm-hmm. people want to see that you're going to do something good for them and with them
mm-hmm.
before they join. So,
well, you've got a tremendous collection. You've got some great stories, which we'll get into on some of the pieces that you have, and some of the pieces in the back room that you have as well. Dr. Darrell was kind enough to give Judge Ginsburg and his wife DC and Allison and I a private tour the other day mm-hmm. of the museum, and got to see some of the archives in the back room that aren't on normally.
Now, before you start feeling special, you know, we offer that to just about everybody.
Darn.
Sorry.
Darn.
But, yeah, people say all the time, you know, they don't get a chance to see behind the scenes and how the museum works, and so we're glad. We are small enough staff and organization with a good, great volunteer corps that we can take people behind the scenes, and we feel safe with that. You know, I mean, we've got enough security measures in place; we're not worried about them seeing behind the scenes a little bit.
You didn't notice what I walked out with.
Yeah, we would have noticed.
Well, before we get into that, though, I'd like to know, and I'm sure our audience would like to know, how do you become executive director of such a prestigious museum.
You know, you get real lucky, actually.
Okay.
You really do. You know, I was not ever supposed to even go to high school, go to college. I barely finished high school. I think I told this story last night.
I was going to say, it's a great story. I was going to ask you to tell it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was, that's fine. I went to 16, 17 different schools in 12 years. You know, my dad was a builder for the military contractors. And so we were at Fort Sill, Fort Hood, just all these forts. And so I didn't have any records that followed me, right? I mean, so one day the counselor comes up to me and, you know, "Mr. Beecham, I've got a problem. We need to know kind of where to place you, and your mother's never sent us your transcripts. You know, she's never brought your transcripts by." My mom was not real big on record keeping. So in the days before the internet, you know, where they could just push a button and have somebody send it, you had to physically have your transcripts. I had 16 different schools, for goodness sake, you know, three high schools. And so I said, "Well, why do you need it?" And she said, "Well, we need to know where to place you in the class." I said, "Well, I don't care. I'm not going to college." So she put me last, 198 in a class of 198. You know. My friend Rick was so glad I showed up, because he was 197 before I showed up. He didn't graduate last. "I'm not last," he said. But I graduated high school, went to work for my dad, concentrated on doing concrete work, concrete and brick, and we were at the University of Texas baseball field building that summer of 1970 and whatever. And it was 110 every day. And after work one day, I walked in and said to my dad, I said, "How much more of this crap do I have?" Meaning that particular job we were on. And he put his old bony finger in the air and said, "You've got about 50 more years if you don't go to school, you don't go to college." And a light went off in my head, you know. So I hauled my butt down to the University of Texas admissions program. And, you know, lo and behold, they don't want the guy who graduated 198 in a class of 198. And they certainly didn't want him at, you know, A&M. I tried all the universities, and nobody was taking this, you know, the guy who didn't want to go to college.
So, yeah, I applied to Harvard hoping some clerical error. Yeah. <10 minutes. laughs>
No, they didn't want me at any of the universities. So thank goodness for junior college and the junior college system. And I went to Temple Junior College, which is now Temple College, and spent 2 years there. Went on to followed a girl to, of all things, to East Texas State University in Commerce, Texas. That's how I chose my college, was I followed a girl.
Did you marry her?
I did not. I did not. I married a different one. She ran off with another guy. But ended up getting a bachelor's degree, you know, became a pretty good student. And went away for a while, worked, came back to the university as an employee. And somebody said, "Why don't you work on a master's degree?" I said, "Well, I don't want a master's degree. I barely got a bachelor's degree. I didn't want to even go to college." And I looked up one day, and all I had to do was write a thesis, and I had my master's degree. And I continued working for the university, which is now Texas A&M, at Commerce. And somebody said, "Why don't you work on your doctorate?" I said, I don't want a doctorate. I didn't want a master's. I barely, you know, got my. And I looked up one day, and all I had to do was write a dissertation, and I had my doctorate. And so, you know, I'm an accidental kind of, you know, academic. I was supposed to be a concrete guy, which is great. You know, it's a good job. I just didn't want to work that hard.
I thought that was a great story.
You know? And so, you know, I found out that the university I had been working for at that point for 7 years didn't really even, they wouldn't hire their own graduates. So I couldn't move up in the organization. I couldn't do anything more than what I was doing. So I taught for a while at the University of Central Arkansas. I came back to Texas to be at Navarro College in Corsicana, Texas, where I have a home today. And for 17 years, I was at Navarro College. I started out as the dean of libraries. One day, an old man named Charles Pierce walked in the door, and he said, "I've got something I want to give to the library." And I said, "Well, you know," I thought to myself, "Great, here's another day Kennedy Was Killed magazine, you know, coming my way, or Time Week, you know, series or something like that." And he pulled out
the World Book Encyclopedia.
Yeah, World Book Encyclopedias, you know, whatever. But Chuck was a collector of Civil War memorabilia, and he pulled out of his briefcase a letter by Robert E. Lee. And that'll shake your world up. You know?
Wow.
Yeah. Abraham Lincoln, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, and all sorts of folks. And man, it was just that, you know, all of a sudden life-changing, because he was wanting to build a collection. And when we were done, he said, "I have two criteria. I want to continue to add to my collection, Peg and I, he said, are Civil War collectors, and we want to continue to add to it, and we want to make it available to the public, make it available to researchers and kids and students. And when we were finished, 17 years later, we had amassed 19,000 Civil War documents, letters, manuscripts.
Good night.
It's considered the largest collection of Civil War memorabilia west of the Mississippi today.
And where is that today?
It's in Corsicana, Texas, just south of Dallas.
So it's available to researchers?
Yeah, available to researchers. Go see my good friend Ann Zimbala, who's the director of that museum, and they'll set you up. I mean, you can say, I want to see an Abraham Lincoln letter, and she will put an Abraham Lincoln letter in front of you.
Wow.
Right? You want to see, and we've got, they had many, many over the years. They added, we've got the original Battle Hymn of the Republic there at Corsicana, Texas, at Navarro College. And I went up to New York to bid on it, and I bid against Harvard and Yale and Fricky, and Mr. Pierce was serious about millions and millions of dollars of investment on his part to make this education. Absolutely. He was a great and generous man. About 2-3 years into the Civil War project, he said, "Hey, about my," he said, "my wife and I have a Western art collection." I said, "Yeah, I've seen it in the home." He said, "We'd like to do the same thing. We're going to give the collection to the college. We want to keep adding." And when we finished that project 14 years later, when it all came to an end 17 years into my tenure, we had amassed about 600 Western artworks, one of the great collections of the Western art world. It rivals the Museum of Western Art in Kerrville. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing. And so,
when we come back, want to hear about, among other things, some funny things that have happened at the museum, and also... Mr. Brinkman's collection.
Yeah, glad to be.
Yeah, Kerrville.
And also, we're going to learn how what used to be the Cowboy Artist Museum became the Museum of Western Art.
All right, we'll be back with Dr. Daryl Beecham, Executive Director of the Museum of Western Art in Kerrville, after these brief messages. So stay tuned to the Bill and Allison Show.
Your freeborn single star sends out its radiance to nations near and far. Emblem of freedom, it sets our hearts aglow with thoughts of San Jacinto and glorious Alamo. God bless you, Texas, and keep you brave and strong, that you may grow in power and word throughout the ages long. God bless you, Texas, and keep you brave and strong, that you may grow in power and word throughout the ages long.
Texas. Welcome back. We're Bill and Allison, Hill Country Patriot. You can hear us anytime at firstcoupleoftexasradio.com. And we are talking today with Dr. Daryl Beecham, who is the Executive Director of the Museum of Western Art here in Kerrville. And he has, I learned something last night when we heard his presentation, how the Cowboy Artist Museum, which is what it was called when we first moved here, and suddenly it became the Museum of Western Art. And I just thought they were trying to, put on airs, but
no, there was actual reason for doing that. several actually. But, 1983, the museum was dedicated as the Cowboy Artist of America Museum, and for 20 years it operated under the CA banner, the Cowboy Artist of America. And the whole thinking was that only members of the Cowboy Artist of America group would be the guys to provide art for the museum collection with the display for the exhibitions, and that worked well when everybody had lots of enthusiasm and it was brand new and the membership of the organization was in its 30, had 30 members or so. But the problem is, it was great for the museum because they are great, great, great artists. But the problem with that whole concept was that 30 guys, 20, then it became 25 and down. At one point got as few down as like 15, 16 guys. They just can't supply the volume of art that was required for changing out the shows on a regular basis, and a lot of them felt like they were working for the museum, right, versus selling their own art and getting ready, because we were requiring a lot of art that flows through the museum, and Then the unspoken problem that we were having was that we were, by very nature of it being a cowboy artist of America, we were excluding a lot of folks, you know. And it was interesting because the Cowboy Artist of America group, as a group, was mostly a bunch of old white guys, you know. I mean, I said that publicly once, and people kind of, oh my gosh, you can't say that. Yeah, I can, yes, because it's 15 white guys, and it's two or three Native Americans, and that's it. There's no women. There's no people of color other than the Native Americans. There's no women. There's no people from other nations. Like some of the Chinese paint fabulous Western art scenes. They love the American Western art. Shangjiang, for example, Mian Situ, are well-known, and they sell, you know, works worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. And we were excluding them by the very nature of it was limited to the members of the Cowboy Artist of America. Great artists like Mary Ross Buchholz, who's a fabulous artist out of San Angelo area, could not be included in the museum. And so in 2003, to solve kind of both of those problems, we became the Museum of Western Art and expanded our mission so that today we can include. Now, we still love the CA, as we call them, the Cowboy Artist. We still love those guys. We're the keepers of their archives. We have a garden out back, and the garden is their handprint, boot print, and signature in concrete of everybody who's ever brought into the organization. So we still participate with the CA. They do a workshop for us. They're doing one this summer. You know, five major CA artists are going to have a workshop for like 90 inspiring artists. So we still get involved with them, but we had to expand our mission a little bit to include other folks. And it took the pressure off them, and it gave us a more inclusive look. I'm not always into the political correctness of inclusivity, you know. But it was good for us, you know. It was something that we needed to do.
Right.
We wanted to be fair.
Well, it sounds like you weren't doing it to be politically correct.
No.
But you were doing it just to include non-white artists.
Yeah, non-white males.
not white old men.
No, non-old white men's club.
That's right.
Great group, great organization, but we needed to do better. So we did. 2003, we became, and we've operated for 20 years under the umbrella of the Museum of Western Art. So we just celebrated our 40th anniversary here in Kerrville, Texas. And, you know, yet I still go to local burger joints with my Museum of Western Art hat or you know, wearing my logo. And some people say, we have a museum in Kerrville?
Oh, no.
Really? And then my other thing I hear is, I've been driving past your place on Bandera Highway for 30 years, and I've never stopped. Mm-hmm. Well, you need to stop. You need to come on by. I figure if we can ever get them in the door, it's a good thing. We can get them back if we can ever get them in the door.
We're talking with Dr. Darrell Beecham, who's Executive Director of the Museum of Western Art, formerly the Cowboy Artists of America. And just like the Hill Country Youth Exhibition Center.
That's right. Ag Barn.
Used to be the Ag Barn. What everybody called it, the Ag Barn.
We still get called the CA Museum, Cowboy Artist Museum, all the time.
And I always call it the Ag Barn.
Absolutely. Tell us about Mr. Brinkman's collection here locally.
One of the founders of the museum was a guy named L.D. Brinkman. His family, he was a businessman, local businessman. He and guys like Bobby Shelton and you know, just a ton of others that are on the foundation of our building, the cornerstone of our building. You know, they got together in 1983 and decided they wanted to build the museum of, you know, the museum, the Cowboy Artist of America Museum. So he was one of the founders, but he was also, you know, a fabulous, fabulous Western art collector in his own right. He was one of those guys who was going to shows and buying. When Mr. Pierce, my mentor, was buying lots of Western art, these guys were buying up Western art, and they were buying lots and lots of it. And he amassed a collection that was probably second to none, about 600 pieces when he died. And when he passed away, the L.D. Brink Brinkman Foundation has placed on loan. It's a long-term loan, is what, you know, officially has to be called. The 150, give or take, works that were in the foundation's collection. He was moving works from his personal collection into the foundation in order to, you know, take advantage of the tax laws and the rules. And when he had passed, he had moved about 150 of those works into the collection. And there they make up the a bulk of the really great portion of our collection today. The remaining part of that collection was sold at on auction in various other, you know, private sources. Bonham sale in California, and the family, you know, liquidated a lot of the properties, as a lot of families are forced to do when they have, you know, inheritances and things like that. But we have 150 of the works at our museum, and we have them out on display on a regular basis, and it's part of a really great collection.
And you have a wonderful book of...
Yeah, we do. We sell a book in our museum store called... it's about the American West, and it's a, you know, a book about the Brinkman collection, how he collected it, why he collected it, and it's got images of the 150 works in our collection, plus the other 400 and some odd that were in the collection as whole. It's a fabulous, fabulous book about
it certainly is
about the American West.
Allison and I are fortunate enough to own a copy of that book, and yes, we certainly recommend people go out to the museum and pick up a copy. Not only will you be, it's a huge.
Yeah, it's a big tome. It's a
coffee table book.
It's a heavy book.
But it's marvelous. Plus, you support the work of the museum that way.
Yeah, and the foundation, Don Brinkman and the L.D. Brinkman Foundation have gifted us those books for sale in our museum store. And so 100% of the proceeds of the $75 book go to the museum. So that's exciting.
That is, because that's not... cheap book to
produce. That's not a cheap book to produce. And so, yeah, they've gifted us his collection of books, and we sell them there in the museum store.
Mm-hmm. Tell us in the remaining time we have with Dr. Daryl Beecham, Executive Director of Museum of Western Art in Kerrville, 1550 Bandera Highway, if you don't know, but I think most people do, museumofwesternart.com. Tell us the story of the... bronze and the is that the Remington?
Yeah, we've got a Remington. We've got several pieces, and one of them that I showed the judges last night at that little workshop conference was a Remington piece, and we own what's called a second gen Remington. He produced 20 of them in his life, and then after he died, his estate produced another 20 posthumously, and we have one of those.
Well, a lot of people would be familiar. It's a very familiar.
Yeah, they, you know, it's the rattlesnake is what it's called, and I mean Remington was one of the most popular artists in the world, and we get all the time people come in and say, "I have a Remington," and yeah, you know, no, you probably don't. You probably have a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy, and for years after he died, and after they lost the copyright, companies were producing quote original Remingtons made from copies of the, you know, first Remingtons, and so they're bad knockoffs, if you will. And we have one of those that walked into the door one morning, and a lady said, "I've got an original Remington." No, you probably don't, but let's look at it. And sure enough, she did not. And we showed her why. I was able to pull out our Remington and put it next to her Remington, and you can immediately see the difference. If you see them separately, you think, "Well, that's a great piece of art," and it really is. It's a very enjoyable work of art, but if you see them side by side, you can see the detail and the craftsmanship and the you know, pour as it's closer to the original. And she was so depressed because I think her visions of a home in Cancun went down the drain. but bless her heart, she ended up giving it to the Museum of Western Art. We use it in part of our education program. We put the two out side by side. We put our original under glass, and people can't touch it, and they can see the details. And we put the other one out, hers out, so that kids can touch it and look at it. And you can clearly see the difference if you were. The judges last night were fascinated by that whole
look. Exactly. We saw them both last night.
Yeah, and so we, you see them side by side. It's really important to look at art, you know, see art.
So as far as value is concerned of the piece that she had versus the museum?
Well, you know, the value that we have on ours is quite substantial, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be $250,000 on some of these works of art. And she asked me, what's the value of hers? And I told her, you know, $3 a pound if you melt it down into something good, you know? And I told her, I apologized because I didn't mean to be flippant, you know, and put, you know, degrade her work. It's a very lovely copy. But it is a copy, right? I mean, it's like having a print of an original. There's a difference between the original and a copy. And I told her, I said, you know, you can get them on the internet for $1,000, you know. That's about what her grandfather paid in 1950, you know. So it hasn't appreciated in value very much. And we do that all the time. I'm not allowed to do appraisals, but people bring in their art, and you're welcome to do. If you're listening to this and you have a work of art, you know, you bring it in to us and, you know, set up an appointment with me, and I'll be glad to look at it. Now, I can't give you an appraisal, which is an official thing. I can give you an evaluation of my gut reaction, if you will. I think this is X or Y or Z, you know, and there's a lot of people who, you know, but the days of finding an original work of art from Remington Russell are probably, you know, you're not going to find many of them out.
Well, coming up after this quick break, we're going to be speaking more with Dr. Daryl Beecham, and we're going to be talking more about fakes and forgeries, which I think are fascinating.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own, more than you could ever know. Make my wish come true.
Welcome back. We're Bill and Allison, and we have here in the studio Dr. Daryl Beecham. He's the executive director of the Museum of Western Art here in Kerrville, and he's going to talk about a quote-unquote artist.
Well, he knows a lot of artists.
There's a lot of artists. You know, I mean, one of the things that's fascinating is that everybody, I see a lot of people come into the museum, and one of the first things out of their mouth is, I'm an artist. It's the only profession, I think, in the world, and I've told people this for a lot, that I can think of, where all you have to do is say, I am, and you are.
I would be embarrassed to do that.
I'm an artist, and you can't prove them wrong, you know? And that doesn't mean you're a good artist, but you're an artist, you know? And you can't do any other profession in the world. You can't cut hair without a license. You can't sell hot dogs without a health permit. You can't be on the radio without having some kind of licensures. You know, I mean, you guys got to have permits to do what you do. You can say, I'm an artist, and nobody can prove you wrong. And if you don't believe that, look at, you know, Hunter Biden. You know, I mean, it's a weird, you know, and I'm not making a political statement as much as saying he has said, I am an artist, and he has sold paintings for $500,000, $200,000 and $300,000. And people have accepted his work and paid him for that. And the government and reasonable people know man cannot paint. He's not an artist. And yet he can claim he is. And so how do you prove that he's not?
Exactly.
When I believe, you know, and again, I'm saying this on The Patriot, I think he's selling influence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you betcha.
You know?
You betcha.
I mean,
why else would somebody pay that kind of money?
Yeah, you know, But my point is, from an art standpoint, it cannot be proven, and it's got to frustrate the government. It's got to frustrate people who say, you know, I mean, you sold that for $500,000, and yet art is so subjective that he can get away with it.
How do you say that's, you know, that's wrong?
You can't say it's wrong, you know.
Look at Jackson Pollock.
It's art, right? Well, you know, because he's in that same vein of people who made millions of dollars, Andy Warhol, Jackson Pollock, there's lots of, you know, art is so subjective that guys like Hunter Biden can say, I'm an artist, and he's selling art.
Get away with it.
Yeah, and get away with it.
Well, that reminds me, Allison and I used to be congressional staff in Washington, and at one point, they were forced, the congressmen and women didn't do this willingly, but they were forced by public opinion to put a lot of limits on what lobbyists could give them, gifts and money and things like that. And, one little trick that they managed to figure out, instead of a lobbyist giving them, you know, thousands of dollars, the lobbyists would invite them to a poker game and get
and lose $1,000.
Guess who won?
You can't prove that he's not a great poker player.
That's right. That's
Congressman,
right.
Are you, you know?
Exactly.
You won with deuces?
We learned something.
Well, we were playing deuces high.
Deuces high.
We learned something else very interesting working for members of Congress. that the congressman's desks, which are very ornate, very high quality, very ornate, but you can open a bottle of Heineken on the
any brand.
On
the knob. Okay.
On the knob.
I like that.
It operated as a beer opener, beer bottle opener.
As it should. Yeah, good for you. Something productive coming out of Congress.
Exactly.
You
know?
Yeah, at least there's something good coming out of Congress.
last night.
Well, if the opposite of of, wait a minute, am I getting this right? Well, if the opposite of pro is con, what's the opposite of progress?
Congress.
What you got, Allison?
I was looking for my room shot, but I couldn't find it. Oh, well, okay. It's up there somewhere.
Yeah,
she's doing a great job engineering the show, isn't she, man? That's pretty amazing. She not only talks, but spins buttons and dials with the best of them.
I couldn't do it. When Harley first asked me to, I was... He said, "Well, you were in radio." I said, "Yeah, like 40 years ago when we had
vinyl and carts." Yeah.
Vinyl and carts, yeah. Exactly. And he said, "Well, you know, you want to fill in for me at Christmas?" And he said, "Come on, I'll show you how to run the board." And I said, "Okay." And the board is nothing like I was ever used to. Plus, I always had an engineer. Pretty much, I think at almost every station I worked in Chicago area, I had an engineer. But anyway, so this board has buttons and dials and three computer screens and two mouses. And all this stuff.
And you have to do this down to the split second.
And it's got
to
be a split second thing. So, you know, I go in and Harley is showing me how to do it. And in the first 15 seconds, I say to myself, I can't do this. How do I tell him, though?
I'm glad you had an Allison with you. That's right.
Well,
to you,
I went home with Allison. Yeah. I said, I don't know how to tell Harley I can't do this. I'll disappoint him. He's my friend. And Allison said, well, let me try. And she spent a week.
I spent a week at Harley's elbow.
Yeah.
Learning the board.
Yeah.
So I don't know what I do if, you know, some morning she's too sick to come or something. This program would not be
let's keep her healthy. That
would not be it could be the Allison show. It can't be the Bill show is the point.
Well, we as we said, we're talking to Dr. Daryl Beacham, who's the executive director of the Museum of Western Art in Kerrville, and he was talking about something very interesting last night at an event he was speaking at that we attended. And he was talking about fakes and forgeries. And one thing that I thought was really, I mean, he explained how you could tell. And the one that I thought was the most interesting was the Charles Russell.
Yeah.
How you could tell a Charles Russell was
for a number of years.
Was a fake.
Yeah, and Allison, for a number of years, I was the director, CEO of the Russell Museum in Great Falls, Montana.
Okay.
So I became very familiar with Charles Russell and his works. We ran across a piece at the Antiques Roadshow thing where I was a guest evaluator for the Antiques Roadshow for a number of years, and a lady came in with this it looked like an original Russell, and it's one of those rare moments people say I've got an original Russell, and it looked like, boy, it really was. So we took it in the back and we popped it out of the frame, and I knew immediately it was a fake. It was a forgery, and I knew that because Russell, when he painted on his canvases before you put a frame on it, he was a cheapskate. He wouldn't clean his brushes real well. And so what he'd do is when he finished with his blues of a sky, for example, he'd knock them off on the edge of the canvas up in the upper left-hand corner, right-hand corner, whatever. And grass was down there in the green, browns in the middle, you know. And he had a place where he put his paints, his extra paints, to get them, you know, get all the paint off the brush before he cleaned it so he wouldn't waste as much turpentine. And I mean, that was his whole thing, because turpentine was expensive.
So that's how you could tell.
And you could
tell
it. So he put it in a frame, right? And you can't see the edges. And so this forger had copied it from a New York apartment. And he had copied this wonderful masterpiece that we had never seen that piece, right? We figured it was in New York somewhere. We've later identified it as part of the collections of Russell. But this lady walked in. She got an original Russell. And by God, it looked like an original Russell. It really did. But it wasn't. And so I got called before a three-judge panel, and that's what the judges were fascinated by last night. And I was asked that question, how do you know? And I said, well, let me show you. And we put three Russells out of the frame and showed them that pretty much all of them had a signature edge to them. And one of the things that we do in our industry is we photograph the edge of important paintings. We've got a lot of the Brinkman collection photographed. It's for insurance purposes. We have a file that if somebody ever was to do a forgery of a work, you can tell the difference between the forgery and the original because, you know, they can't see the edges, right? It's behind the frame. Mm-hmm. So unless you're in the presence of the master himself and know the way he painted, or you can see it without the edges, without the frame on it, you can't really, you know, paint a forgery and make it work. And so that's one of the little secrets of the trade. You
that's
know,
fascinating. So. Before we run out of time, Family Free Day.
Yeah, Family Free Day. Every last final Saturday of every month, we have an opportunity to have everybody come out to the Museum of Western Art. If you want to check it out for the first time, that would be a perfect day because we have patrons. We have people, patrons who provide the funding to make that happen. So you get in free on Family Free Day, you and your family. There's usually crafts. There's usually Darla Feister, our education director, is usually doing some kind of craft for adults and children. And we sometimes we have lectures going on or artist demos happening on a regular basis. It's the last and final Saturday, not the fourth, but the last Saturday. So if there's five Saturdays, and it's the fifth Saturday of every month, Family Free Day at the Museum of Western Art. One thing I will point out is that everybody who comes into the museum, there's a $7 admission for adults, but if you're a first responder, firefighter, police officer, or ever served in the U.S. military, you get in free.
What about radio broadcasters?
Radio broadcasters, if they were served, if they served in the military,
okay.
You know.
Full boat, huh?
Our members are always free. That's exciting. So if you want to join the museum, come as many times as you like with your family. Then we have various different levels of membership. But if you're a first responder, firefighter, or ever served in the military, which is a lot of Kerrville, a lot of people in this region, bless your hearts, we have local people who give to that cause who help us overcome the financial parts of it. And they make contributions for it. And we're glad to let people in free. And you know, like I say, we're open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4, by appointment.
Great.
We'd love to see you at the Museum of Western Art.
Dr. Daryl Beecham.
Thank you very much for joining
us. Director, Museum of Western Art. You know, time flies like an arrow. Fruit flies like a banana. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not unto your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths.